What do you know about Joy-Con drift?
Joy-Con drift. Oh man, I have taken a Joy-Con apart in my day. So let's.
Hey, me too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you also did that.
So
oh, wait, is this the intro, or are we just said talking?
I mean,
about
I think
intro?
So.
Okay. Well, right? Now let's. No? We can start over.
I mean, you want to try it?
I just fucked it up. But no, I definitely can talk about Joy-Con stuff.
We could just do an intro. That's just is this the intro? Or are we just talking about the intro?
Maybe it is.
I don't know if this should be the intro. Right, maybe this is the intro.
It's wrapped back around to being the intro again. So here we are.
I mean. I was going to talk about how Animal Crossing has completely exposed all that every Joy-Con in my house has drift.
That sucks. I feel so lucky. I haven't had that yet. Is it really noticeable? I mean, I guess it has to be noticeable, right?
So there's a combination with Animal Crossing of no aim targets, plus the fact that the stick moves on its own.
Oh God, the aiming is so bad in that game to begin with.
Oh my God. It's the fishing is so that and the fact that I'm pretty sure they've written the fish in that game to the moment you cast aim the other direction.
I would believe that.
It's just it's supposed to be a chill, fun game. And I'm just getting fucking angry at those fish.
Animal Crossing is a harsh master. So I'm not clear if Joy-Con drift is 100% guaranteed to happen to all Joy-Cons eventually, or if it's a sporadic thing.
My understanding is it's when dust gets between the sensor and the into the sensor.
Okay. And it's, so it's registering false positive contact.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. And the way it works is usually like on mine, at least the sticks move. Okay. But then sometimes when you release the stick to stop, it doesn't stop.
Huh.
Or sometimes if you like bump it the tiniest bit, it'll register a big move and it'll just go.
I'm sure that is
so frustrating.
Can you kind of like feather it with your thumb to correct it back to neutral, or is that not
kind of
great? That's not great.
I'd been playing a lot of Animal Crossing. I picked up an Xbox 360 controller the other day and I was like, oh man, this is so nice.
Yeah.
It just does exactly what I want it to do.
Yeah.
So there are fixes.
Yes.
Oh wait, you can like pop off
home fixes.
Yeah. You can replace the sticks. You can get aftermarket sticks and replace them. It's just a couple of screws and a ribbon cable.
Oh, I think I saw that on iFixit. They're like, what, $15 a stick or something like that? Or is it for
I think
two?
It was $15 for two, maybe on Amazon is what I saw.
Okay.
Or you can also just open it up and blast it out with air and hope for the best.
Oh. I mean, they will fix it, but we're both in the situation where we've made some modifications.
They're not going to fix mine.
Yeah. Bro. You could, if you still have the original housing, you could put it back together and maybe they'll never know.
They'll know.
Yeah. They always know.
They can always tell. Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm Brad.
Brad.
Well, yeah,
when we're doing the show together, you don't have to say thanks for having me.
We're doing that again.
Man.
This is what it's come to. I'm already going back to the well on old material.
Oh, God, this material is killing me.
I've used that one at least three times now.
How you doing, man? How's stuff?
Fine. You know, maybe going a little stir crazy in here, but it's cool.
It's sweaty over here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's sweaty down in Pacific. It's real humid today in Pacific.
It's clammy up here and foggy and gross. We're both on different ends of the gross spectrum.
Exactly.
Right,
I'm still wearing my jammy pants, so I got that going for me. Happy Sunday.
I haven't put on long pants since the 10th of March, probably. Why would
my
you?
My beard is ridiculous at this point. I'm gonna have to trim the mustache or else I'm going to start eating hair all the time.
You're getting into good like Unix kind of sysadmin territory there, I think, if you just want to keep going.
I'm going to have to decide between shaving my head and getting a ponytail before too long. It's a dark time.
We had a serious discussion this morning about my girlfriend cutting my hair.
Yeah,
that's where we're at.
So the woman who cut my hair for most of the last 20 years is doing like video consults where she tells one partner what to do when the other person is cutting their hair.
That's enterprising.
And it's like, that is fucking genius.
That is entrepreneurial.
She's very good.
That's good.
Hey, we have business. We made a mistake last week.
Yes, we were very sorry.
We forgot to thank our executive producers.
We did,
which is uncool.
Oh.
We're new at this, is all I can say. This is my first podcast, so
same.
a belated last week. And I guess also this week, thank you to David Allen and Andrew Cotton,
dude,
who support the TechPod Patreon at the executive producer level.
Gotta,
thank you guys so much.
We got to stay on the boss man's good side. You know how he gets.
I know they're the man.
Yeah.
And of course, thanks to all the Patreon sponsors
of
the show.
Thank you everybody so much.
This week though.
Yeah.
What should we talk? You want to talk about we both have projects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow it turns out that being stuck in the house leads to us tinkering with a bunch of stuff all day long or whatever.
It's what we do. Yeah. We've been talking about the Mister a lot lately. Yes. And you and I both made some purchases. I think you're further along than I am.
Yes. Although still in some various state of completion. Nice. What do you want to start? Do you want to start with the 4 in RAM? I shouldn't lead with that, but I just did.
Well, you sent me a link to this guy in Portugal
I don't want to put him on blast.
I'm not upset. Just to be clear. I'm not worried or anything. Okay. I'm not even concerned at this point because PayPal, if you're a buyer, PayPal would give your money back for any reason whatsoever, including you shipped it and it arrived.
I'm not worried about him getting scammed. He came recommended by some of the most trusted figures in the Mister community. So I'm not worried about that at all. It's more just,
it's all good.
It's been a few weeks. I'm not sure what the state of the shipping is, but I'm not about to hassle somebody in the middle of a pandemic about it.
So I want to talk about your build because we're doing basically very similar builds. I don't know if you're doing an output board, but I'm not planning on it.
The IO
at least
board?
Not right now. The IO board.
No, I thought I was going to. I started out just thinking I'll just buy everything. Why not? Let's just get the whole kit and caboodle. Who cares?
Yeah, go big.
That thing is, what is the price on the IO board? Is it 50, 40, 50? I think it's 50.
It pushes it up to 350 for the whole thing, probably 325 for the whole thing.
But as an individual part, I want to say it's around $50.
That seems right.
It gets you VGA out, analog audio, 3.5 millimeter out, optical audio out.
Will it drive an arcade monitor too? Is that a different thing?
I don't know. So I think the VGA, I'm getting close to talking out of my depth here, but there are multiple standards that'll come out of that VGA port. SCART.
I saw there was a SCART adapter.
SCART is one. I've still never quite understood what SCART is. Is SCART the same SCART, as RGB? Or are those separate?
SCART is RGB plus with luminance with other channels separated out, as I understand it. I think SCART was an audio production thing or a Euro thing. I've never encountered it in real life.
I know that port will do VGA into an actual PC VGA monitor. It'll do SCART and stuff like that. If you have an actual CRT, you definitely want that board. If I had room to get the old monitor out of my parents' basement, I would absolutely get that thing. But for me and you, if you're using HDMI only, it doesn't seem really worth the money.
And it's not like you can't add it on later.
No, you absolutely can. The two quality of life features on the IO board that are kind of universally good to have are it's got three buttons on it for reboot and stuff like that.
Ooh.
Which is kind of nice to have, but kind of whatever. And it also serves as a fan mount. It has a mount on it directly over the chip on the DE10.
Can't you just put that into your case though? Presumably,
no. There's nothing to mount it on by default.
Well, but if you're making your case,
I'm planning on
laser cutting some cases.
Yeah. So that design I sent you.
Yeah, it had a hole.
Exactly that. Yeah. So if you have access to a laser cutter or 3D printer, there are designs out there for just a dumb, and by dumb I mean no electronics in it. A 2D cut or printed fan mount. So you're on that tip right now.
That's my plan. When you have a laser cutter, everything looks like it should be laser cut.
I was going to mention to you earlier, but I'll just tell you now on the podcast. That design I sent you has designs for top and bottom plates. And if you haven't cut them yet, I think at least for me, you can skip the bottom plate. I don't see any reason to.
You're just going to leave no pants on your Mister?
I mean, if you want to. If you've got extra acrylic lying around, I won't turn it down, but totally don't have to.
Sheets of acrylic cost essentially nothing.
Oh, really?
They're very inexpensive. Well,
when it occurred to me to ask you if you would laser cut this for me, I first thought I should at least provide him the raw materials.
Oh, dude.
And I started looking around and I was like, I found some places charge an awful lot for laser cut acrylic, but maybe that's a special...
It depends. Okay. So if you go to Tap Plastics and you buy a big sheet and get them to cut it into pieces that will fit in your cutter, it costs a couple of bucks a sheet probably.
Oh, wow. I was looking at the wrong suppliers then.
Well, but also I bought a Glowforge and they did an affiliate code and I gave my affiliate code out when I was talking about the Glowforge a couple of times. So a few people bought and they gave a certain amount of credit for materials for everyone that everyone that bought a laser through your affiliate link. So I haven't bought materials in 2 years for the Glowforge.
Okay. We're fine. Suddenly feel way less bad about asking you to laser cut that stuff.
I was thinking about doing my case in like maple or something, like nice, making a fancy nice wood and doing a little stain so it looks like a...
I don't think I'm going to do a case, actually, for
really?
A couple reasons.
Just a frame?
God, there's so much to talk about with this thing. I'm trying to keep it all straight. Let's talk about this. So cooling.
Yeah.
It's not super crucial. Apparently that thing can manage without any kind of active cooling or even mm-hmm. passive cooling, but like just most people seem to just want to extend the lifespan of that thing as long as they can. So they are adding cooling to it. So I wanted the high end Noctua fan, which is quieter. It's not necessarily like better at cooling than the $2 fan, but it's quieter and that thing sold out everywhere. So I actually bought a bigger fan.
that
fan's not going to fit in any cases. So
I saw yesterday either in the TechPod Discord or my Twitch Discord, people were talking about there being a fan shortage.
Yeah.
Like coolers in general are out of stock all over the place.
That's what happened. The Noctua that everybody buys for that thing, it's the dimensions are 40 by 40 by 10 millimeters. And that one is just gone. You can't get it right now.
But, that's a weird low profile fan.
But there is a similar, I shouldn't say this out loud. You should order one of these if you want it before this podcast goes up, because there might be a run on them. but there's another, Noctua makes another fan that is 40 by 40 by 20. So it's double the height. So it won't fit. It won't fit in a lot of the standard case designs, but it is actually quieter than the 10 millimeter one. So it's actually better if you don't mind this fan being kind of, you know,
I like my fans thick, Brad.
Yeah. Well, then I have the fan for you. So I've got heat sinks and thermal tape that I can peel you off, because that stuff apparently only sells in bulk. The fewest heat sinks. So the heat sink, I think the biggest heat sink you want for a mister is 22 by 22 by 10.
Okay.
And the fewest of those I could get was 10. So if you need a mister heat sink, I got you.
There's something spectacular. Like there's something. So there's a thing that the prop community does when like somebody wants to make a bunch of Han Solo blasters or something, is like 40 people will each make one or two pieces, or order one or two pieces, or have them fabricated or whatever. And then they all share the pieces together.
Okay.
And like, there's a thing about this mister that is happening with this, like
I'm starting to get that vibe.
Cases. You've got some cooling stuff going. You know, it's a lovely community project.
Yeah. Next time we meet up, we can do a little swapsies. I'll get that fan mount from you and I'll give you a heatsink with the thermal tape on it.
I'm looking forward to it in 2030 sometime.
I don't know how deep you want to get into this. I bought some DuPont cables. I had never heard of a DuPont cable until.
I don't know what a DuPont cable is.
They are, they're used for breadboards. So
ooh,
this is an audio podcast, so this doesn't exactly play, but I could.
Are they like the little jumpery ones?
Hold them up and show them to you right now.
Oh, yeah.
They're literally just like female on one end, male on the other pins. Like
I didn't know what those were called.
Yeah, I'd never heard the term DuPont cable before. Also, like speaking of buying in bulk, the fewest of these I could get was 80.
What do you need, like two?
I need two.
Yeah.
So if you want, I will also peel you off a couple of DuPont cables. That's because
I would love that.
The IO board also has a fan, an actual proper fan power connector. And if you don't
buy, so you're jumping.
So if you, yes. So if you don't have that, your fan is going to have to go into a couple of the GPIO pins directly on the DE10.
Got it.
And so
okay,
you'll need a couple of these. It's literally, you're just connecting up the fan cable to the board itself. So it's not a problem. But cool. The point is, like, we'll do a little swap meet next time we are able to leave the house and get that stuff set up.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So that's kind of the DIY cooling situation is, you know, like you'll want to get a fan, assuming you want a fan. Like you probably are okay with just a heatsink, but
my two concerns with this Mister thing are that Intel will stop subsidizing the DE10s at some point.
That's been my fear also.
Yeah, so I want the one that I buy to last a long time, and they're like $130 or something. Yeah. It's a little bit too expensive for me to buy just a spare to keep around.
They're not disposable.
If it was $50, I would buy two, and I would have one in the closet that's just there for when the first one shits the bed.
Yeah, well, especially because I'll give you a heatsink and the fan. If you don't care about noise, a $2 fan, a $2 5 volt fan is perfectly fine.
I'm going to plug this into a TV, and you know it's fine.
Yeah. So wait. So do you have your DE10 yet?
I haven't ordered it yet. No, that's the last piece I have to get.
Okay. So I've been dinking around with mine since I don't have the RAM. There's very little I can do with it.
Yeah. What can you play? Just Genesis games?
So Genesis and TurboGrafx, and I believe, so like the Game Boy Advance core will run, but I believe not all games will work. Like the bigger games don't work because they need the RAM.
Okay.
So I haven't tried GBA yet, but TurboGrafx and Genesis work just fine.
What's on the TurboGrafx you want to play, Alex Kidd?
I went straight to, no, that's a Sega joint.
Oh, that's a Sega. Okay.
I went straight to the beginning. Played some Keith Courage in Alpha Zones. Turned into that. The rainbow came down from the heavens and I turned into a giant robot.
I don't think I've ever played a TurboGrafx game. It's probably
a questionable platform. It was better in Japan.
Okay.
It is one of the two cores that I can run without the SD RAM on that thing. So I've been fiddling with it. But the main thing I've been fiddling with that on that thing actually is network sharing.
It's the core part of every classic classic console sure. game is the hooking it up to the network.
Most people buy a big SD card and just drag games directly onto it.
Yeah, that seems reasonable.
But I've already got all my games on this network storage that I talk about all the time.
So it's nothing like adding an extra layer of complexity. Yeah.
So I just want to point the mister at that.
But you can really connect the thing to the network? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. It's got an Ethernet port on it. Once you add USB ports, there are approved Wi-Fi adapters you can use. It totally works.
Wow.
So not a problem. I was able to mount, like the Linux kernel has Samba CIFS built right into it. So you can literally just use like command line level mount commands to mount your network share. So I did that and it works fine. Like near as I could tell, I put some Genesis games directly on the SD card just to see. And as far as I can tell, they load just about as fast over the network.
How big an SD card are you talking about? Like 128 gigs or like a 32 sitch
that I'm using?
Yeah,
I'm using the 8 gig that came with it because all I need is the OS on there. But like, I think people are buying as big a card as they can get because some people are putting like Sega CD and PC Engine CD games on there.
There's something to be said about just having a box that you can take to somebody's house and plug into a USB port.
Totally.
And like plug it into HDMI and be good to go. Yeah, right?
I understand the appeal of having the games portable and like, you know, especially cartridge games are small enough that I could still put a bunch of them directly on there if I want to. But like for me, it's more about organizing. Like only having to organize in one place and just kind of have a central repository. Like, because I'll probably also want to point a RetroArch install at this same repository at some point.
So the thing for me is that I like when I do these emulation projects, I usually really curate the games that are available to the point that it's only like maybe 20 or 30 games. Otherwise, it gets just too overwhelming.
Sure, I can. Yeah, like, I mean, as of right now, I think I kind of want the whole set just to have the access to Barbie Horse Adventure if I need it.
I like to play those Japanese horse racing sims. They're pretty fun.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a gotcha coming up with your network share.
I was debating whether to bring it up or not. So I've mentioned before I've got like local DNS hostname resolution set up in my router.
Yeah.
Which sounds like whatever, but I can't.
No, it's really handy because then you just check the machine name.
Absolutely. So like, yeah. Especially now that I'm SSHing into like three or four different things on a regular basis, not having to remember look up numeric IPs for everything is fucking amazing. Like,
yeah,
being able to connect to freenas.lan or mr.lan is so much better than having to remember those IPs. So I've been able to mount that share from the Mr. command line by numeric IP, but for the fucking life of me, I cannot get it to mount by the host name. Meaning that if that IP ever changes, I have to go into the Mister and manually edit that IP to update it to point to the new address, right? So I have spent all fucking week looking at NetBIOS resolution and like mucking around in smb.conf and using SMB client to try to figure out what's going on there. And I just cannot get it to resolve that host name. And it's killing me.
Is it a problem? Is it the Linux? Registering the name on the DNS from the Linux side?
No, I can like ping that host name and it returns it pings and sees the numeric IP just fine. Samba seems very particular about the way that it resolves host names, which is separate from how the base system does it.
I had this problem when I set up the FreeNAS box and I couldn't get my Linux machine, which was running Octopi, my 3D print thing, to show up at all. I had the exact same problem in a very similar situation. I eventually just put a host file entry in for the places that I use the most, and that solved the problem enough that I didn't care about it anymore.
Right. Like I could just stick with the numeric IP and move on with my life. I just refuse to admit defeat at this point. So I'm going to keep banging on it, but Because it is annoying. Like I changed my network IP range a couple weeks ago.
That sounds like a nightmare.
It was a pain for a few days. But are you now,
a 10.15 now? Yes,
what'd you do? I'm 10.0. 10.0.1.0.
Bold choice.
It's fewer numbers to type. That's true. How many different, that is, it's at least three less digits every time I type an IP on my network now.
I mean, it's funny. I switched to a 10 keyless keyboard a couple of years ago. And the only time I miss it is when I'm tax season, when I have to do a bunch of spreadsheet stuff. And then also when I'm typing in IP addresses, because I can bang out a 192.168 unbelievably fast.
I can't live without the numpad. I need it.
I have an external one I pull out in April. So that
the Raspberry Pi that I use as my NUT server has to have a static IP for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. And that's the example. Like when I changed my network range, I forgot to update that IP beforehand. So then I had to crawl under the desk and like pull out the Raspberry Pi where it is buried and like hook it up to a TV and then edit the IP manually. So like that's why I try to use hostnames for everything, because it all just works once it's set up.
Do you fixed IPs for the hosts, for the ones with the host names?
Just dynamic? Just for that Raspberry Pi. I let the DHCP assign IPs to everything.
Oh, see, I fix everything that's static and just do it with IP address.
I could just set a static IP for the FreeNAS machine and then not have this problem. But
I like your commitment to doing it the right way, Brad.
I like your
commitment to doing it the right way.
Yeah. Anyway, Mister's a fun project. The last thing real quick I'll say, I just found a kind of a handy tip. If you happen to be running your Mister into a video capture setup like I am, instead of having to change inputs on my monitor to see what's on coming out of the Mister, which obviously you lose most of your Windows desktop that way, the camera app in Windows 10 is a pretty handy way to see what is coming into your HDMI capture.
Oh.
So like you could use OBS for this, or you could like straight up start a Google Hangout and also pipe it in that way. But the camera app is like literally just open start menu and type camera. It's made for webcams. It's made for like taking pictures of yourself or whatever. It's just a dinky, tiny little lightweight app. It'll take the feed of any video in device that's coming into Windows.
Wow, I didn't know you could do that. Yeah. I don't think my capture card works with it. I don't think it has the right drivers.
So I can't find a way to change the device in the camera app. It seems to just pick one.
Yeah.
So with my webcam unplugged, it pulls up the Magewell capture device that I'm using. So anyway, it's a nice way to have like, you know, the Mister console window open in one app and the video out open in another window. Kind of go back and forth for testing and stuff. So that's my Mr. Testbed setup right now.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
that's fun.
I got tired of using VoiceMeter to deal with streams and podcasts and stuff like that.
Really?
VoiceMeter is a software mixer, and
it sounds awesome in concept.
It is an incredibly powerful tool. The problem with it is you can't really monitor. It doesn't give you a way to monitor your audio program feed live. Like if you're streaming, like I've been doing a lot of streaming because my work is dead right now. So I've been doing a lot of streaming, and since I can't monitor the program feed when like somebody's low or my game is hot or I'm not audible next to that, you can't hear anything. And also, when VoiceMeter crashes, you don't get feedback, so you don't know that something's gone wrong.
Until
somebody says something.
Somebody in your chat says, "Hey, no audio."
Yeah. Okay. And so I'm working on a project that requires me to be able to do recordings that I need to be able to monitor, but I don't have somebody here to monitor them because I'm doing it in my house. And I went and bought a mixer.
Nice.
And I asked the internet, and I asked Jason from Giant Bomb and a bunch of other folks, and a lot of people were like, look, you could probably do this with an analog, like a stock, like a Yamaha analog mixer, like the ones we used to use Whiskey and the ones we used for the Tested podcast for years. But if you want to up at a level, maybe add a little bit of pizzazz, get some digital goodness in there. Behringer makes these mixers, these digital mixers that are the X Airs.
Behringer sounds like a company that makes audio hardware and also military hardware. like I would not be surprised to hear that they also manufacture AR-15s or something. It just sounds like a rough and tumble company name.
I think they're English. They're probably quite polite and peekies out for the tea or whatever. Okay. But yeah, so I got the XR18, which is the lowest end model that does a USB out, so that I can plug into it as a shows up as a DAW, DAW in my Windows interface. And holy crap, I have spent so much time learning how to use this. So this is the baby version of what you guys use in the studio at Giant Bomb.
Okay, so like a thing that almost looks like something in a recording studio, like a musical recording studio? Like
tons of
knobs and sliders and stuff like that?
None. No knobs, no sliders.
Oh, what?
I could rack mount this thing.
Oh.
It has rack mounts.
Okay, now I get what you're saying.
And it has 18 ins and like or nine outs.
Wow. How do you control all that stuff?
So I have an iPad, or there's an app on my Windows machine. So you know the iPad that Jason carries around in the studio?
Is that?
It's that thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So.
That's kind of handy.
Because it's all software, you can route everything everywhere. So like I have buses. So it's designed for like live stage shows and studio stuff. So like if you're doing this for a band, then you have a live mix, a different mix goes to the drum, and a different mix goes to the vocals, and a different mix goes to the lead guitar, and they all want to hear different instruments at different levels so they can keep pace with each other. I don't need any of that stuff. But it has let me set up Discord on one bus, game audio on one bus, my audio on one bus, and I can't remember what the last thing is. Oh, like stream notifications and stuff like that.
Sure.
Or music. And it has been absolutely fascinating.
God, it sounds so great to be able to split all that stuff out.
Well, and it also includes, so like in a normal analog mixer, like those Yamaha mixers we used to use, remember when Vinny got the compressor and all of a sudden we could yell when we were doing the live show?
Yes.
So it has this, like normal analog mixers have kind of shitty compressors built in. This thing actually has software modeled compressors built in. I don't know how that stuff works, but like I haven't figured out how to work that stuff yet.
Oh,
this has been like last night I figured out how to mute stuff and unmute it using my Stream Deck. Okay. So that was very exciting.
Sure.
It's been a gradual process.
Baby steps.
Exactly.
That sounds awesome though.
And then it's been really fun.
So how many devices are you seeing or in Windows, or is it, how many devices is Windows seeing? I should say, like how many extra sound ins and outs are you suddenly juggling in there?
So, by default, it shows up as one MME device, one stereo MME device, or MME or WDM audio model. But if you're using software that speaks ASIO, which is the low latency, it's a closed source licensed low latency protocol for connecting audio devices to computers, basically, and audio devices to other audio devices. And if you use that, that shows up as like 18 inputs.
Wow.
And then you can pipe, like I'll post a screenshot in the show notes or something, but like if you post the ins and outs, then you can see the whole, like you can send any of the sliders on the digital thing can be either a USB input from the other computer or a line in or a microphone or an instrument or whatever. So I guess I'm gonna have to get a keyboard as the TLDR here.
Sure. What are some examples of software you're using that supports that ASIO standard? Like does OBS do that, or do you need like higher end professional stuff?
So OBS doesn't, because it's not compatible with the licensing for OBS.
Oh, sure.
But VoiceMeter does.
Okay.
So what I'm doing now is using VoiceMeter to route stuff into specific inputs.
Man,
so
you've just got virtuals on virtuals on virtuals.
Look, it's virtual. It's just mixers all the way down now, Brad. It's been like, this is one of those things that I finished my stream at like midnight the other night. And I was like, I'm going to plug in this new mixer and see how this goes. Cause at first I was like, I'm going to clear off my entire desk, unhook everything, and I'm going to do a clean wiring job. And then I was like, oh wait, that's a bad idea.
That is a multi-day. Because I could tell you from experience over the last month, that is a multi-day project.
Well, but not only that, I was like, I have to make sure I have all the wires right before I do that. Like I need to figure out how this actually works before I go through and like tear everything down and rebuild it. Cause then what's going to happen is I'll fuck something up and I'll have to just redo the whole thing again.
Sure.
So I didn't tear it all down. I just, I like scooched the PS4 forward 6 inches and just jammed the mixer in behind that.
That's the noisiest part of the desk. That's always the first step.
And then I ran a bunch of like my right length cables hadn't come yet. So I just ran a bunch of 20 foot XLR cables along the back of my desk, which is not ideal. and I got it working, but it was one of those ones where at like 3 o'clock in the morning, I was sitting here, I was like clicking a button to see. And then I was playing on the streaming PC. I was playing Spotify on one output. I was playing YouTube on another output. On the game PC, I was playing Spotify on one output and something else on another output. And I just kept hitting buttons to see what worked until it was like an infinite number of monkeys in front of an infinite number of switches. And eventually I worked it out.
And an infinite number of virtual audio devices.
It turns out all the virtual audio devices. But thanks to Jason and Vinny and all the people that helped answer questions on that, because the audio channel on the Discord was incredibly useful. And I was deciding what to buy.
That stuff seems super powerful. You're doing it the right way. Like, learn how to use it first and then run all the cables. But is the full on desk rewire still in your future? It's so satisfying. I know it's a ton of work and it's a huge pain in the ass, but it's so much better at the end.
Hey Brett, how's your monitors doing right now? You got those new monitors in?
Yeah.
I'm not changing the subject. That's not at all what I would be doing right now.
The 15-year-old monitors are in the floor. I'm on some new shit right now.
So I'm gonna pull everything out at some point in the not too distant future, because like this stuff is not, there's a better way to arrange things, and I want to get like separate headphone ins and outs set up where it's easy to plug in and unplug and all that stuff. So
it is a huge undertaking and a huge pain in the ass if your setup is anything like mine, but
you have no idea.
So satisfying and so much easier when you're done. Like, people, like, we get this all the fucking time, but like, people are always just like, why aren't they just streaming 8 hours a day? What else are they doing? You know? And in this particular work at home case, like, that was the better part of 2 weeks for me. Like, just about every day at some point I was lying down on my back under the desk, like pulling cables through mounts and like hooking stuff up. And it was just a massive undertaking, but it was so worth it. I'm at the point now where I can just plug in a Switch or a PS4 or this Mister and just go, you know, like, it's literally 30 seconds to plug something in and hit go. It's such a useful investment of time to get all this stuff set up.
That's where I want to get is I have the right splitters and stuff to be able to switch from Switch to PS4 or whatever.
That's even beyond me.
Well, I mean, I still have to unplug a cable, right? Yeah. But it's like,
okay,
the in into the splitter, one half goes to a monitor, the other half goes to the capture card.
That's what I've got now.
And that, like, setting that up so I don't have to crawl under the table to unplug stuff is so good.
It's so good.
But yeah, the next phase is to like think about routing audio cables so I'm not picking up weird noise from crossing like monitor power and stuff like that, but also have the XLR ins and the headphone outs.
You should get
where they're easily accessible and all that stuff.
You should get one of those ground loop isolators. It's good to have around.
I need one.
It's good to have around. It solved my problem in a miraculous way.
I did have a ground loop when I was setting this up, and I solved it by taking a piece of metal, a piece of wire,
okay,
and hooking it onto the shield from the headphone from the XLR in. And hooking it, just touching it to a piece of metal on the back of my monitor. That solved the problem.
That also works.
It's everything's better now. I don't know.
It's just physics.
Yeah.
You just gotta tell those electrons where to go.
Exactly.
Yeah. Should we move on to the next thing?
Yeah. I like this Project Cornucopia. Yeah, this is fun.
Going on. You know, we're just stuck at home right now. I gotta find stuff to do.
I got the projects.
Why don't we talk about, you want to talk about my free NAS backup extravaganza? As I have labeled it here in this document.
Nothing's more fun than backing up. That's what I always say. Have you done the restore yet? That's the question.
From virtuals on virtuals to backups of backups. although really, I mean, I have been working on this, but really this is just a gateway to talk into this, or into discussing this week's scandalous news story.
We don't normally do news here, but it is core to our interests, I think it's worth getting into.
It really is. A lot of people on our Discord have been also talking about it, and I have been personally affected by it, so we're going to have to discuss it because I am in a fit of pique over it at the moment.
What is the scandal, Brad?
Should we just get right to that?
You've teased it enough.
We've talked too much about it. So apparently there are actually only like 3 actual manufacturers of hard drives left at this point. It's Western Digital, Seagate, and Toshiba.
Yeah.
I guess everybody else is out of that game in terms of actually making them. They're just, anybody else selling hard drives is just rebadging one of those.
Do you think in like 20 years, people are going to be like, man, you can't play original Xbox games without a hard drive. If the load times aren't there, you're not getting the core experience. It's just, it's like CRTs.
If you're saying that hard drives are going the way of CRTs, I am completely fine with that. Fuck a hard drive. Like even in the best situation, just the risk of mechanical failure and all that stuff, just no thanks. But this is worse. Yeah. This is way worse.
What did they do? What did the three manufacturers do?
I hope I've got a handle on this. I got a decent understanding of it at this point. The short version is there is a new type of platter technology in hard drives called SMR, which is a shingled. I should have had this in front of me.
Yeah, it's like the bag of nuts on YouTube. The person touches this bag and it makes a scratchy sound in your microphone. It makes you get tingles in your spine.
It's known as SMR.
I love that shit.
In the community, yeah, I believe. SMR. Yeah, people are way into it. No, it's shingled magnetic recording is the name of it. So
that doesn't sound fun.
The upshot is that the read and write tracks on a normal hard drive are kind of adjacent to each other like you would expect. Mm-hmm. And in this shingled version of that, the read and write tracks actually overlap like shingles on a roof.
And oh, wow.
The whole reason this exists is my understanding is it is simply a play to increase the density of data storage on this in the same amount of space, which makes sense, right? Like they're making it overlap instead of being end to end, which means they can cram more into the same amount of physical space.
This is like when they switched the bits from being horizontal on the parallel to the platter to being perpendicular to
kind
the platter.
Kind of.
Yeah. But now they're angled and on top of each other.
And there are mechanics to the way that reads and writes happen on hard drives on magnetic platters that I don't fully grasp here.
Okay.
The upshot is it's a cheaper and more efficient way to cram more data into the same amount of space at the massive cost of performance.
What exactly performance is impacted?
So from what I understand, I think I've got this right. These SMR hard drives actually function a lot like the SSDs do with trim, where trim is basically a process of the SSD going in and handling, or the OS, depending on what level it's happening at. But it's a garbage collection feature of it's going in and rearranging stuff during kind of idle times or when it can.
So there's on SSDs, there's a mechanical like writes. Basically each cell has to be prepared for a write after there's been data in it.
Right.
So if you're doing that during downtime, there's no impact. If you do that during a write, then your writes slow down dramatically.
Totally. So this is a similar situation, except that here it's because these tracks overlap. And so
are they shipping these drives with trim?
So yes, not to get ahead of ourselves, but the way people have found this, because these companies did not disclose that they were starting to slip these into the channel, is by pulling a bunch of hardcore SmartMon tools diagnostic info off of them to see like what features they support, and finding that these hard drives are reporting having some kind of trim support, which
weird
makes no sense for a hard drive, at least in a classical sense, right? But it's because these drives don't write to themselves exactly like you think they do. Like they don't directly write to where the data is supposed to go.
Yeah,
I believe the site is called Blocks and Files. Let me check. Yes, blocksandfiles.com is the name. I hadn't heard of it. It sounds like it's a pretty kind of hardcore storage enthusiast site.
I like their infographics.
But they have, and maybe this is a sign of just how far down the NAS hole I've gone. I should never say that again. That I find this interview incredibly entertaining. It's an interview with a guy who is the network manager at a British university who has a ton of hands-on experience with this stuff. The upshot is these SMR drives do not work well in RAIDs at all, like to the point that they are basically useless. Like they fail constantly. A lot of RAID setups are just going to reject them out of hand because they don't work right. And he describes a situation where basically these drives have a bunch of like DRAM cache, and then they will have a small amount of CMR, which is the standard. I forget what the C stands for, but CMR is the previous. It's what all hard drives were until SMR came along.
Okay.
Constant, maybe conventional magnetic recording is what all hard drives have been up until this new technology. So he basically describes a layered process of like there's some DRAM cache, there's a small amount of CMR space on the platters, and then a bunch of SMR, and that the drives themselves are, you know, kind of temporarily writing data to the CMR area, and then in downtime they will move that data over into the SMR at a much slower rate. And so file systems like ZFS and like hardcore NAS type setups, RAID setups that expect hard drives to behave like hard drives are flipping the fuck out about this and just like rejecting these drives completely.
Well, okay. So I was going to say, so this seems like this isn't, if I have a PC and I want to have like a media storage drive, this doesn't seem like that big a deal, right? Like this could be a good way to get a cheap big drive.
It is okay for random reads, I believe. It's really bad at random writes. That's when it grinds to a halt. So this SMR technology, and this is why this is scandalous, is that this tech has been around for a while, and apparently it's like very popular in the archival and kind of cold storage space. Like, if you're going to write a bunch of data to a drive sequentially once and then like never change it and just read from it, or even better, like stick it in a closet and not touch it, it's fine.
Makes a ton of sense.
But for high performance, erratic type read write situations, it is completely useless. And none of these manufacturers have disclosed that they have silently started slipping this new type of drive into their old product lines.
But they're not even putting it in the NAS lines, right? They're just putting it in the consumer
Western
drives.
Digital. Dude. Western Digital's red line, like certain sizes, I believe it's the 2 to 6 terabyte tier of the red line, is these drives now.
The 2 terabyte tier?
Two to six. Like the higher, the bigger the drive, the less likely. It sounds like they're not shipping this in like 8 to 10 to 12 terabyte drives right now.
I'm fine then.
Well, I'm not. I don't know what size drives you have. So I have 4 reds in my NAS, and they have worked fantastically.
I have four red 8 terabyte drives in my NAS.
Well, you're fine. If you bought them
they're
like
old,
more than a year, you're totally fine.
2 or 3 years ago, yeah.
But I bought a 5th red of the same size, 6 terabytes, last summer, just as a spare.
Yeah.
Because that's
shingled.
It's good practice.
You got the shingles.
Keep a cold spare in the closet.
You don't want to. Yeah. Like you get, it's like the chicken pox, but wow, that sucks.
Why the fuck would they
put these in the NAS drives? That makes no sense at all.
All kinds of speculation about it. Like they're basically just sounds like they probably didn't test this in a lot of the actual workloads that will be happening in a lot of NAS scenarios. It's widespread enough at this point. Like Anandtech noticed this stuff a few months ago and didn't really report on this like bait and switch, which is exactly what this is. But they did say like, hey, avoid these SMR drives. Like they're not what you want. IX Systems, who is the company behind FreeNAS and TrueNAS, and they make like enterprise, you know, systems.
Yeah.
Like they don't make a free open source thing. Like their actual business is enterprise NAS boxes and support for corporations. They sell machines that cost tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, they're making file servers these days. Yeah,
they have an explicit stance that you should not be putting SMR drives in NASs, which sucks ass because as of right now, according to this interview with this network manager, they are still putting Reds in their enterprise boxes, and he actually contacted them and they were unaware of this issue. So it feels like it's like Ars Technica picked it up this morning. Like it feels like it is. I'm fucking pissed, man. Like I paid because the Reds are a premium.
It's a premium.
You're paying a premium for a longer warranty, and like these are drives that are supposed to spin 24/7 for like years at a time.
Yeah,
and you are paying a premium for that. These aren't like you're not shucking a consumer portable drive off the shelf. Like you're paying them extra money, and they like it feels like just deceit or deception of the worst kind to. You know, like you're kind of betraying the people who should be your most loyal customers by giving them like a substandard product. Well, it's just terrible.
And I mean, the unfortunate thing about the whole thing is like if instead of the idea of it having one part of the drive that is like the good for writes part means that you're going to be doing the least efficient kind of moving from one place on the platter to the other place on the platter. And that's just going to flatten your performance.
Totally.
And
then exactly what's happening.
Yeah. This is unfortunate.
So they seem to be of the mind that if like you said, if you were using this on a desktop for just kind of like scratch storage, like whatever, it's probably fine because the drive then has a bunch of idle time to handle its business. But the problem is like, if you have a drive fail in a raid and you put one of these in and that you're basically
you're rebuilding
what was on the failed drive, right? So you are writing to the entirety of the disk for like hours and hours at a time. So that drive that needs all this downtime to handle its own garbage collection type stuff gets none of that time.
Or it's going to shit the bed.
Or it insists on taking that time and stalls out, and that's why the raid sees it as a failed drive and like boots it out of the array. So there's an amazing quote at the end of this interview I mentioned. Where they ask this network manager, like, hey, were you ever able to actually get one of these drives to work as a replacement in an array? And he says, I was able to force the drive to resilver, which is the term for replacing a drive in a ZFS RAID, by switching off write caching and look ahead. This dropped the drive's write speed to less than 6 megabytes per second, and the resolvering,
holy shit,
and the resolvering took 8 days instead of the more usual 24 hours.
Wow.
More worryingly, once added, a ZFS scrub, which is a RAID integrity check, has yet to successfully complete without that drive producing checksum errors even after 5 days of trying. So you literally have,
wow,
you literally have high-end drives that are targeted at the NAS market that are
that
useless,
fail when you put them in a
that
NAS.
Are useless in very specific common NAS scenarios. Like, it's mind-blowing that this is happening. I don't know what to do, because I bought this drive last summer. Like, it's not like I can return it to the vendor anymore.
And on
it's,
eBay.
But I bought it as a replacement for when one of the drives fails in my NAS, and like it will not work for that. So what am I going to do with it?
That sucks.
It's like I feel like I should call Western Digital and tell them,
yeah, give me a new drive.
You need to fix this, or I'm probably done buying Western Digital products forever.
I can't even imagine how do they make this right? They're gonna have to replace millions of drives.
We are being justifiably hard on Western Digital, but it has come to light in the last like 24 hours that Seagate and Toshiba are also doing this with various product lines.
Oh boy.
So it's kind of everywhere. Like, it is.
I mean, this seems like a problem that maybe ZFS can change the way it works, but it sounds like from the way you're describing the problem, it seems like that isn't possible.
The opinion of this in this interview that is expressed is that it needs to happen at like the drive firmware level.
Yeah.
So it's possible that,
like, you can switch the drive to ZFS mode or something, and then it handles it differently.
But it sounds like that's just going to be a band-aid on the problem, because this technology inherently is just slower and less efficient.
Well, like, it seems like if they put an SSD style cache on the drive that could be, instead of putting it on the platter, that might solve the problem.
Maybe.
But then it's still going to make the resilvers take a really long time.
Yeah, and the bigger problem is just like, you bought something and got something else, you know? Like, they did not deliver the product that people have over years come to expect that they were buying.
Well, sucks.
It's picking up like a lot of outrage in various tech spaces. Like I said, Ars Technica and some other bigger tech sites are starting to run with it. It almost feels like it has the makings of a class action lawsuit. The only thing that I wonder about is if this is such a niche market that there might not be enough members to justify forming a class.
Look,
but I don't know.
Think about all the hard drives that go into servers every day.
That's true.
If
companies like IX Systems are being blindsided by this, like, that's
Google and Amazon and Microsoft and all the people that run big cloud servers get their drives from somewhere.
Right.
And like, probably they're specking to not get these drives, but maybe not. Who knows?
Like,
we'll see.
Like, Backblaze is why I bought WD Reds, because they
published
their stats and like they had good failure rate statistics. And you can't trust any of that stuff anymore.
You can trust the failure rate statistics still,
those numbers are going to change because the technology has changed. It's just an insane situation. I just don't know what decision making process could have led to this happening.
Brad, we can make these drives for 10% less than we make the good drives.
Yep.
And that's going to make X. That means that our bonuses are going to be a lot higher.
That is probably the most offensive aspect of this whole thing, is it's not like they were passing the savings along to the consumer.
Oh,
well, it's not
it's not
like the drives,
those drives are expensive.
The drives did not get massively cheaper. It's repugnant, man. Anyway,
well, on that happy note,
what do you got going on?
I spent yesterday noodling with Minecraft RTX.
Oh,
the ray traced version, the long rumored, long confirmed, I guess, ray traced version of Minecraft. And I fired it up yesterday with my daughter, and she's my Minecraft expert. We did some Minecrafting. It's really neat. The lighting and stuff works. What they did was a normal Minecraft texture has two layers for the actual texture and then the transparency. So, for example, like a railroad track has, you know, the track part that you can see, and then also has a transparency map that tells the game which parts of it are, you know, it's just a straight mask. So like when you load up the second layer of the texture, there's a black place where the tracks are not.
Right. It's like an alpha channel or whatever.
Basically. Yeah. So they added four new channels to the textures for, I think, luminance, metaliness, like how shiny it is.
Yeah.
Reflection. Whether it's emissive, which is how much light it produces.
Refractive, there's like probably.
I think
because that would be like glass and water and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, so there's definitely a refractive, but they don't mention it in the white paper on NVIDIA's site.
Oh, wow, they put out a white paper? That's awesome.
There are white papers on white papers.
And I love when video games are also research projects.
Yeah.
I love when the worlds of like games and academia collide or overlap.
It's very cool. Roughness in a height map, a normal map is the other thing.
Okay.
So basically, in order to get into the beta, you have to download, it's the Bedrock edition only, so your Java stuff doesn't work, like your Java mods and all that stuff won't work.
It's unfortunate that split exists, but I guess I get it.
I think, having played a fair amount of both lately, the Java one, I don't know. It seems like it exists because it has mods and a large player base, not because it's a cutting edge technology platform.
I think that's exactly the case. But I mean, they could bring that modding infrastructure over if they wanted to, right? Like, it seems like
maybe
it seems like they have chosen to, like, because they're monetizing Bedrock servers quite a bit and that kind of thing. It seems like they've tried to keep it as much more of a closed system.
Yeah, they're monetizing on realms and on content. So you can buy like content packs and texture packs and stuff like that.
Like Java Minecraft is old school, like Wild West Minecraft, and then Bedrock is Minecraft as a service, right?
Pretty much. I think that's fair. So they also added a physically based renderer. So I'm trying to think of a good example. You remember like Yoshi's Crafted World, where the world looks like it's made of cloth and everything's bouncy and it's all part of the material system. And so they added that stuff. They're doing path traced ray tracing, and it's lovely. It is absolutely stunning.
Looks like good.
In the stream, I set up a bunch of stuff and we noodled with a bunch of stuff and we explored. They made, I think, 6 or 8 worlds that they paid creators to make. They also built some showcase worlds where you can kind of see what's going on in the, like how the new texture components work and all that stuff. But we loaded up one of the worlds and started trying to make a camera obscura. Like, we were doing light tricks.
Holy shit.
And it works.
It works. Wow, man.
It's hard to get enough light in, but like, you can do that.
This is the first moment I've ever wanted an RTX card.
So then somebody suggested that we try to do the 2-slit experiment.
Oh, wow.
And I set that up. It took a little while and it didn't work. Aww. Right. We get two lines instead of 4.
Okay.
And somebody in the chat was like, right, it's because they're simulating rays, not waves. I was like, oh, right, there's no waves when you're doing ray tracing. It's just straight lines.
Man, that's incredible.
So, of course, the 2-slit experiment doesn't work.
Man, fucking fake photons.
Yeah. Get out of bullshit here with photons, man. It's really, like, if you have an RTX card, you should definitely go to the Windows Insider Hub, sign up for the Minecraft Bedrock RTX beta, download it. It's got a lot of limitations. There are ways that you can build your own worlds using the new textures, but there's a process and you have to go to an NVIDIA site that I'll hopefully remember to link in the show notes. You can't play on realms because it's a different version. It's a fork of the main Minecraft. And any worlds that you open in the RTX beta will not be able to be opened in normal Bedrock Minecraft. You also can't have normal Bedrock Minecraft and the RTX beta on your system at the same time. So like, I'm having to switch back and forth, which is a little bit of a pain in the ass, but not that big a deal.
How's your performance? Is it running?
I was running 1080p because I was streaming and it was like solid 60 pretty much everywhere.
Wow.
Right. They also do the good thing where you can press the semicolon key and it switches back and forth between RTX and not RTX.
Oh, wow.
So you can see like the non-luminance, non-shiny textures, which is really cool.
I am absolutely going to go watch that stream. I want to see that.
Yeah. The water stuff is really, really cool. It is absolutely, like, they do refraction on the water in a way that like when you're above the surface of the water, you can see things, they look bigger. And as soon as you dip in, just like in real water, it looks like the right size again.
Oh, that's so great. That's
and so also, exciting. Brad, when you're underneath the water, if the light's right above, then it reflects the floor of the ocean rather than letting you see straight through to the sky. Wow. Like you get some transmissiveness and it is really well done.
It is so exciting that those consoles have got, you know, codified ray tracing hardware in them. And once all games are capable of being designed around this, like it's going to be so great.
I mean, we talked about this, this is like the third episode we did. So it was half a year ago.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And back then I was still a little gun shy on how long it was going to take to roll this stuff out. Yeah. And since then we've seen Control and this, and like, I'm really, really excited about what's going to happen with the next consoles because of the ray tracing stuff.
I think I was a poor ambassador for this stuff because the first like year or something that the RTX stuff was out, people were just like, whatever. It's a little bit shinier. Like, who cares? And I was just like, no, you don't understand. It's going to be so awesome. It's just going to take a while.
But it's taking a lot less time than like, if you look at like the DX8 transition to a programmable pipeline, it's taking way less time than that did.
Totally.
Which is awesome.
Totally.
So, it seems neat.
That's good. Try it
if you have an RTX card.
Yeah.
Okay. I got one more.
All right.
Over the last like 3 months, the lights in my kitchen have been gradually going out one at a time.
Oh, like out, not or dimming.
We're just first blinking. Dimming, okay. Then kind of blinking on and off, and then just stopped working.
Are those LEDs by any chance?
It's funny you mentioned that, Brad. They're first gen Cree floodlight bulbs for in ceiling applications, like canister lights.
Yeah.
And they were hooked up to a first gen GE Z-Wave smart switch that was the only, for a long time, the only switch on the market that worked with two wire lighting installs, which is what my house has because it was built in the 50s. So I was like, shit, I think this switch has finally died. It's like 10 years old. It's time to pop it. So I popped it out. I ordered Lutron, has started making Casita, I think is how it's pronounced, light dimmers and switches that are compatible with two wire installations, which, just to be clear, like two wire installations is everything built before the 90s, pretty much.
Is that, I'm almost afraid to say this, but is that power and ground? Is that what those wires are?
So when you have a two wire situation, it is like a loop between, there's power coming in one side and then that wire goes straight to the light and another wire comes straight back and goes back to the switch.
Okay.
And, or one of them does, I guess, both of them don't. But when you flip the switch, it closes that loop. And when the switch is closed, that loop just doesn't exist.
It's the standard old school wiring is what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Like electricity is not my forte.
Well, the problem with smart switches is they need to have a little bit of power all the time. And if they're not set up right, then that doesn't work.
Oh, because they need a connection active to receive commands, right?
Right. And to be able to turn on. So I thought that switch had died because it's been janky for a while. And I ordered one of these Lutrons also because I wanted one of the Lutrons because they look really cool. And I popped it in and didn't fix the problem. So I was like, shit, maybe the bulbs are dead. I can't believe these bulbs are dead. They're probably 8 years old. They're on a lot because they're the kitchen lights and we use those lights all the time. And I got new lights in the other day and put them in and it's like the surface of the sun in there. Like, holy shit.
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, it's good. I thought I was just getting old and my eyes were getting worse and I was like having less light sensitivity, but no, it's just half the bulbs in our house are 10 years old and are starting to get dim.
That was the insidious thing I realized when we did that LED lighting episode. It was back around the holidays, I think. Once I did that AB comparison of those Christmas lights that I had bought, like,
yep.
It's subtle and gradual enough that you're not going to consciously notice like, oh, these lights are getting dimmer. When is the, you know what I mean? Like, I think we talked about that then. It's like, you're not going to know, hey, it's time to replace these lights because they're still putting out light. You know, it's just, it's going to, your lights are gaslighting you into thinking that your eyes are going.
That happened to me. It can happen to you. Man. Anyway, I've replaced all of them. They're good. The one thing about those Casitas, if you go with those switches, is they do have a bulb compatibility list and they disclaim the warranty on the switch if you don't use compatible bulbs.
Okay.
The bulb compatibility list was enormous. And I was able to find bulbs that I liked that were in the right, you know, price range and all that stuff. So, I mean, I guess 10 years, 9 years on light bulbs isn't too bad. 8 years on light bulbs,
whatever. That's pretty good.
Those were also the first gen LED Cree floods. Like that was the very first one that they released. Cause
we've had pretty good luck with Crees.
I find that they're pretty safe.
Yeah.
Like the GEs and some of the other bigger, like more traditional light bulb brands, I've had to send some back cause they were like, they just didn't look right.
Right.
But the Crees I know are going to look like a light bulb.
Yeah, they look good. Least. And eight, 9 years is getting into that territory of like, you probably saved plenty of money on electricity, right?
I would hope so. So the bulbs that I got are 100 watt equivalents that draw 16 watts, I think.
Yeah.
Which and is, you know, a fifth basically.
Over that period of time. Yeah. That's a long time.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So
the joys of smart home ownership.
But I mean, props to the Lutron folks, because that thing is really cool.
Yeah.
And the fact that it works on all the switches means that I have a lot more options now.
That's cool.
I think that's as good a place as any to wrap it up, Brad. Yeah,
we've got a lot. I mean, there are multiple projects we didn't even get to on this list. So we've got,
we'll do another one in the future.
We're still just kind of sitting here in quarantine looking for things to tinker with.
I've got a laser project. I'm working on a robot that we'll talk about in the future. I think I'm going to ask for some help from folks in Discord because I don't want to buy 15 different motors to figure out what I need to do, the thing that I need to do. And I think there's people in there with that expertise.
Just don't give that robot self-awareness.
No. Never.
Just learn from the Terminator, please.
Look, first we have to 3D print the guns and then we give the robots the guns and then we give them self-awareness for personal defense.
We'll just put it in
Second Amendment, Brad.
Put in an algorithm that they can never turn the guns on human beings. That'll work perfectly,
yeah.
Right? That's,
yeah.
Those are foolproof, right?
Defend all life.
Yeah.
That's the way.
That's right. Serve the public trust.
As always, thanks to our producers, everybody who supports the Patreon, especially our executive producers, David Allen and Andrew Cotton. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, everybody.
And everybody who is backing the Patreon. Yeah. It is wonderful to see fascinating conversations every single day in the Discord.
Yeah. It's a fun place to have. I'm not trying to like goad people into supporting us. I actually genuinely just think it's a super fun place to watch people talk tech.
Well, I think we're like, and other stuff too. Like we have the food channel is booming where people are posting recipes and stuff they're making.
Yeah.
We have a lot of stuff going on in the maker, like the maker channel was about robots this week, which was awesome. I think we might make a robot channel. And then there's been some impromptu fruit swapping going on in video games. I think Animal Crossing related.
Yeah.
All sorts of other good stuff.
You dropped something in there that we hadn't even discussed beforehand, so it was a surprise to me. And I don't know if I might be playing with fire by mentioning it out loud, but it was an idea for a supporter benefit. That I'm incredibly excited about. And I don't know if we should talk about it because it doesn't exist yet.
You can. Like if
you said the magic letters,
go ahead and say it. And then if people respond really positively, that will be an impetus to get it going.
BBS.
Bibs.
I don't know what form that would. I mean, obviously, that would be an over the internet form at this point and not an over telephone lines form. Although if you wanted.
Yeah, I think it would be something you SSH or Telnet into or whatever.
Give me a reason to set up four phone lines in here, then maybe we can
look. You need a PBX software. You can run that on a FreeNAS in a container on your jail on your FreeNAS. And I think the thing we need is I think a BBS to run like some old BBS games and stuff on would be really weird.
Yeah,
and fun,
like people were talking about Trade Wars on there, which I was always intimidated by back in the day. It seemed really complicated to my.
Was Trade Wars like Dope Wars, but not with drugs?
Maybe I'm inflating how like the complexity of it. But in my 14-year-old mind, it was like a very hardcore strategy game that like you had to check in on every day and that kind of thing. So I don't know, but like I played a lot of Legend of the Red Dragon and some of the other door games on BBSs like that.
Like if you want to do that, we can just start a Neptune's Pride game and do it for Discord for subs for Patreon members, and then we'll all hate each other at the end of a week.
Put a permanent end to this podcast. I can't imagine what modern BBS technology looks like, if that even exists, if people have like added onto and created new stuff over time. But I also just like the idea of making a time capsule like 1993 BBS as well. So
like get your Doom shareware there.
Yeah. So we absolutely have to go on ftp.idsoftware.com and download the Doom shareware and put it on our BBS.
I am into this idea. And if people like it, let us know either in the Discord or send us Twitter messages at SweatpantsTech. and we'll I'll see if we can make it happen.
Yeah,
it sounds really really goofy.
Yep.
But yeah, thanks for listening, everybody.
And yeah, thank you,
Brad. Yeah, hope you're safe. Wash your hands. Stay safe.
Be well, everyone.
Yeah, everybody, take care of yourself, and we will see you all next week on another Sweatpants Tech Pod. Nope, that's not the name of the show.
It is now.
Fuck.